Welcome to the Wealth Studying Podcast. This is episode 61. It's December 18th, 2014. I'm your host, John Pugliano. I'm also the founder and money manager at investablewealth.com. Well, if you're a new listener, welcome to the podcast. Our mission here is to help teach you 10 wealth building principles that you can apply in your life so you can not only build your net worth, but more importantly, so you can attain personal freedom. If you're not familiar with our wealth building principles, go back and listen to the first 10 episodes. That's where I lay out the foundation of how I've not only built my own personal net worth, but more importantly, my personal freedom and independence. I like to say that money may not buy happiness, but it can buy freedom. And that's what we're all about here at the Wealth Studying Podcast, freedom, helping people build freedom. Well, if you're paying attention to the markets, you know they've certainly been turbulent, but in the last 2 days, they've been turbulent on the upside. I personally am sitting this one out. The water's a little too frothy for me right now, but with 2020 hindsight, I would have liked to jump in Tuesday afternoon as the market was falling apart and hitting its lows, because since then, the S&P 500 is up about 4.5%. Yeah, 4.5% in the last 2 days of trading has been phenomenal. As we talked about at the beginning of this week, I was pretty sure that the market would get a bounce after Federal Reserve Chairman Janet Yellen's press conference on Wednesday. The Fed usually comes out and tells the market exactly what it wants to hear, but oh boy, did it ever get a jump. To me, it's irrational exuberance, but hey, you can't argue with the scoreboard. But I'm not getting back in until things settle down, and I'll give you a full market analysis tomorrow on Friday after the markets close. Today, I want to talk about something else. Before I mention today's subject, though, I do want to just give you an idea of volatility. As you know, the last 2 months or so, I've been a big proponent in investing in consumer products, particularly those that are going to benefit from the lower energy costs. We took some profits in the general transportation industry, and I'd mention about some trucking companies and an airline that I'd have been invested in. Something I haven't been invested in up to this point, but I've been looking at, and I've been looking at daily, and that's the recreational vehicle segment of the market. There's a lot of interest in RVs, not only because of demographics, but also because fuel prices have just dropped so much in the last 4 or 5 months. In general, RV sales have been up, and the companies have done very well over the last probably 2.5 years. Anyways, they are something that's been on my watch list. Haven't really talked about them in the podcast. I might have alluded to them here and there. But let me give you an example of volatility. Two companies that are virtually the same. Like yesterday, we talked about McDonald's and Burger King, and virtually they're the same company, and yet one of them is doing extraordinarily well this year, the other one not so much. But when it comes to RVs, you can say the same thing about two companies. Thor Industries, which makes the Airstream brand of products, and then Winnebago, which obviously makes Winnebago. Now, these are obviously two very distinct brands, but overall, you know, from a 30,000-foot view, when you look at them, they're pretty much the exact same company. They compete in the same markets. They pretty much offer the same type products. Again, it's sort of like a Big Mac and a Whopper. Yes, there's differences. Yes, there's some people that hate one and love the other. But bottom line, these two companies, they're making two very similar products. Big, very expensive land yachts. As I mentioned, I've been watching them. It could be a time to get into them because these fuel prices are so low. It's obviously going to drive sales. Sales have already been escalating since we've come through the recession, and demographics are favorable to them. There's a lot of reason people are buying them. But here's the bottom line. Today, Thor Industries was up almost 3.5%. And at the same time, Winnebago was down almost 8.5%. And actually, intraday trading, it was down way more than that. It was probably down over 10% intraday, but it closed at about 8.3% down. But why would that happen when these two companies are virtually indistinguishable? Well, Winnebago announced earnings. They weren't as great as people were expecting. Sales are up, but they had problem meeting demands, and there were just, you know, some glitches here and there. Overall, still stable company. Nothing is really that different on them today than it was yesterday, except for the fact that their stock is worth a whole lot less today. Well, the funny thing on all this is about maybe 3 weeks ago, Thor Industries, the Airstream people, they announced their earnings, and they had a similar story. Their sales were up, but the earnings didn't meet expectations. And they took a big plunge, although I don't think it was, I don't have the chart in front of me, I don't think it was as bad as Winnebago's today. Anyways, it's just an example of how turbulent the markets are. You have to be really careful when you're picking stocks, whether you pick a Big Mac or whether you pick a Whopper, because if you choose the wrong one, you can get hit over the head with a Whopper. Anyways, more on that tomorrow, Friday afternoon after the markets close. Today, I want to talk to you about oil pricing. And like all things on the Wealth Studying Podcast, although we're going to talk around nuts and bolts on a particular subject, at the end, I'm going to come back and wrap it up and try and draw an analogy as to why it's just not about oil, but how you can relate these same concepts to other areas of your life, not only investing, but just general economic activities in your everyday life, even your interpersonal relationships. But let's start out talking about oil. Do you have any idea what it costs to pump oil out of the ground? And I don't mean the fully loaded cost where you put in the transportation costs and all the operational costs and, you know, and marketing and sales and all those kind of things, but basically just to pull it out of the ground and then to pay what they call royalties, which basically royalties are the extortion fee that the local government or the local jurisdiction charges the company that pulls the oil out of the ground. Now, the numbers I tell you of what the actual cost of pulling oil out of the ground is are going to surprise you. So we've been conditioned, particularly in the last decade or so, to think that oil is worth a whole lot more than it is. We've gotten used to paying around $4 a gallon for gasoline. We've gotten used to seeing the headlines where oil is up around $100 or more a barrel. Well, let me give you some numbers, and I'm going to start at the high end. And again, this is going to surprise you. Venezuela, you know, they're pretty much a basket case socialist economy. The primary way they generate their income is through oil production. They're a member of OPEC. From what I've read, they're one of the most inefficient producers of oil in the world. Now, their fully loaded costs with royalties and all isn't much different than their overall pumping costs, and it's somewhere around $40 a barrel. Yeah, think of that, $40 a barrel, and they're about the most inefficient people. The Russians aren't too far behind them. The Russians are probably somewhere around $32, $33 a barrel. Again, that's with the royalty fees plugged into it. Russian oil itself is very cheap, though. So if you actually take the cost of pulling it out of the ground, it's probably more like $15 a barrel. But if you're like ExxonMobil and you're working with the Russians to extract it from the ground, you have to pay those extortion royalty fees, and that about doubles the cost up, you know, somewhere around maybe $32 a barrel. United Kingdom's costs are about the same thing. You know, they're drilling oil up in the North Sea where it's very expensive. It's a very harsh environment. With their royalties, the cost to pump oil out of the bottom of the North Sea, it's somewhere, you know, north of $30, maybe $32 a barrel. Now let's bring it home to the United States. Overall average production costs in the United States with royalties. Okay, so that's paying all the local jurisdictions in the states and all those people. You're talking somewhere under $25 a barrel. That's with royalties. You take out the royalties, the average cost of production in the United States, this would be on land as well as like in the Gulf of Mexico, the numbers that I'm looking at are telling me somewhere below $10 if you take out royalties. Canadian oil is a little less, probably somewhere right around $20. Mexican oil is probably only about $10, and that's with royalty in it. So if you just look at production in North America between Canada, U.S., and Mexico, our average production cost with royalties is probably somewhere, I don't know, $18 to maybe $21 a barrel. It's amazingly cheap. And if you go over to Saudi Arabia and Iraq and those countries, they're well under $10. The numbers I'm looking at with royalties, their costs for oil are somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, $7 or $8 a barrel. Now, again, you have to factor in transportation. I mean, there's a lot of other costs associated with that, but it's nowhere near the $100 or the $117 a barrel we've been paying in the last 5 to 6 years. The point in bringing all this up is I want you to realize when we talk about oil possibly going to $40 a barrel or even oil stabilizing around where it is now, say around $55 or under $60 a barrel, it's a very real possibility. We've been in a paradigm of peak oil and scarcity and paying through the nose for gasoline and oil when that's not the case. The fact of the matter is that the world is awash in oil. These oil cartels have held the price up too long, and now the chickens are coming home to roost. And that's ultimately why you've seen the vast fluctuations in the marketplace in the last 3 weeks or so. There's a lot of fear that between junk bonds and certain sovereign debt funds, you're going to have defaults because these companies and these countries that are focused on energy may be too over-leveraged. And although the cost of extraction of oil is very inexpensive, their social structures and their debt that they've built around mining oil are quite expensive. And so we might see some defaults. That's really what's been jittering the market. But here's the point I want to bring up about general investing. How do you as an individual investor know what you can believe? Because you can see one article written by someone that's for peak oil. Their bias is all around peak oil. And they're going to tell you how the shale boom is a flash in the pan. The production costs are under-exaggerated. The life cycle of these wells is too short. I heard a speaker not too long ago talking about how all the oil was drying up in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, he was very convincing and very emotional and just really harping on peak oil. And this is, you know, at the very time that the bottom's falling out in oil prices. And the other end of the spectrum, you're hearing people saying, no problem. You know, oil's practically free. There's 10,000 years supply of it. You know, so who do you believe? As an individual investor, you just don't have the time to research all these different positions. So, you know, who do you believe or what do you believe? Well, I'm not going to tell you what to think. But I do want to help you with your critical thinking skills. And so let me explain my thought process and my rationale a little bit. A few months ago, although I knew that oil prices were coming down and I'd been looking for this actually for 2 years, I was way overestimating when I thought would see the drop in oil prices. It took a lot longer for them to collapse than I thought they would. But I was still unsure about really what the production costs were. It wasn't important at the time because the market wasn't reacting to them. So I really didn't waste my time to dig into it to find out what they were. I just knew they were a lot lower than what we all thought. I had heard, for example, that production costs in Saudi Arabia were around $25, $20 a barrel. Well, I'm telling you now that I'm looking at the numbers, they're well below $10 a barrel. So I was way off. But again, it didn't matter because the market wasn't reacting to lower oil prices at the time. So since we've had this collapse, I have gone in and I've looked at the numbers. But even before that, I could rationalize in my mind and know that the costs were a lot lower than where the oil was set at. And although I didn't have hard numbers to back it up, I had more than just a gut feeling or just an intuition. And let me tell you how this thought process worked for me. I knew that despite what you hear in the media about fracking and all the shale oil production, that's really not a new phenomena. We've been fracking in this country for oil since after World War II. I think it was 1949. So that's a long time. It's a long history of fracking. It's nothing new. What's really new are the techniques that we could use with horizontal drilling, which is basically robotic and directional drilling. You combine that with fracking, that's really what's created the revolution and helped us get the oil out of these shale reserves. And again, these shale reserves, we've known about them for a long time. We've known about the sand tars up in Canada. And the more we study shale, the more we know there is of it. In my area of the country, in the Rocky Mountains, there's a section called the Green River Formation. It runs between, Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado. It's a shale formation. And the last things I've read on that is that there's literally hundreds and hundreds of years of oil production that's recoverable. Now, a lot of that's on government lands, and we're not going to get at it anytime soon. And government lands are not something we're going to talk about today, but that is something you have to factor into the equation. All the oil production that's come out in the last 7 or 8 years, where we've basically gone from producing around 5 or 6 million barrels a day to producing over 10 million barrels a day in the United States, that's all come from private lands. And a lot of it is production from what they call wildcatters. Guys like Harold Hamm up in the Bakken region in North Dakota. It wasn't Shell or Exxon or Chevron or any of those guys. It was these little wildcatters, these little independent guys that had a parcel of land that they knew that there was oil on, and they had nowhere else to drill. They had nowhere else to go. And so they worked on it for decades to get this oil out of the ground. And that's the point right there, is that these people have been developing these wells for a number of years, for decades in some cases. It's just that they were persistent and the technology has gotten better, and that's why we're awash in oil right now. But here's the point, and this gets back to how you can educate yourself and how you can know in a general 30,000 foot viewpoint about something without having to dig down and study all the numbers to the exact science. The way that I knew that oil prices were too high and would be coming down is because what I had studied about the Bakken region in North Dakota. And I really think that that's the key to understanding overall oil prices, even though it's not the most significant oil fields in the U.S. or in the world for that matter. But the reason that North Dakota Bakken is so important is the history of it. See, this isn't something that they've just been doing for 2 or 3 years. From what I've read, I know that they've been exploring for oil in those shale regions in the Bakken since at least the year 2000, and I'm sure it was even before there. But I have seen numbers where they were exploring for oil in 2000, and then as early as 2003, 2005, you could see where there was a trickle of oil coming out of there. Nowhere near that million barrels of oil that they're pulling out of those fields today. But here's the point. 14, 15 years ago, they were exploring. They were not only exploring there, but they were exploring there without much success and with no history of success. So how does that relate to the cost of oil? Well, that's just the point. Let's step back 14 or 15 years ago. What was the cost of oil before 2003, before we first invaded Iraq, and then we've had persistent nonstop problems in the Middle East? What did oil cost back then? Well, from about the mid-1980s to about 2003, the average price of a barrel of oil, and this is the market price sold on the market, not just the royalty price or anything, this is the fully loaded market price, it averaged over about a 20-year period from mid-1980s to 2003, a barrel of oil averaged around $25 a barrel. That's right, $25. There were times in those 20 years when it was significantly less than that. So here's where the logical thinking skills come in. If oil was averaging around $25 a barrel, and they were still exploring for oil in North Dakota, in the Bakken field, with unproven technology, in a very inhospitable place to live and work, it's like Siberia in the winter. It's extremely hot and humid in the summer. There's no infrastructure up there. And yet these wildcatters went up there and they developed those fields. And what was the market price of oil? $25 a barrel. You see, they weren't up there exploring for oil when it was 120, 107, you know, when Brent crude was 125, or even in 2008 when oil hit its peak and got up around, I think, $145, $147 a barrel. They were exploring and trying to pump oil in the early 2000s when oil only cost $25. So if they thought it was profitable then, 14 or 15 years ago, when the market price of oil was $25 a barrel, doesn't it make sense that they could still be profitable today when the market price of oil was around $55 a barrel? Well, it makes sense to me, and that's one of the reasons that I knew that market forces were going to bring the price of oil down, and everything we were hearing about peak oil was a big fib. And today I'm not going to cover the propaganda of that big fib or that big lie. I'll let you draw some of your own conclusions, but look at it from this perspective. That fib wasn't perpetrated by one person or one organization. It just wasn't OPEC. There are a lot of nation states, oil-producing countries, and crony capitalist companies that make a fortune and benefit unbelievably from high oil prices. So when you hear all the environmental gloom and doom, and when you see the never-ending violence and fear and instability in the Middle East, in my opinion, that's all perpetrated by these countries and these companies that want to keep high oil prices, because the world literally is awash in oil. So this critical thinking skill that I want to point out to you, I've talked about it before in other episodes, it's where you take things to the limit. You put limits on the end and you say, well, if I take things all the way to zero on the left, or I take things all the way to infinity on the right, what answers do I get? And then you'll know the truth. You'll know the truth in infinite terms, and you'll know the truth in zero terms. And then from there, it's like dealing with propaganda. You have to extrapolate and triangulate and say, well, I know we're not at zero and I know we're not at infinity, but I know that those are the two anchor points and I know the truth lies somewhere in between. And if the agenda that someone's trying to market to you or cram down your throat is outside those limits, you know that they're either wrong because they have inaccurate data, or they're wrong because they're lying to you. And what I just described to you about the North Dakota Bakken shale fields is an example of taking things to the limits. So the way I constructed that was, I said that if you're going to drill for oil anywhere in the United States, one of the least hospitable places to do it would be in North Dakota. And yet that's where people went, right? It's bitter freezing cold in the winter, hot and humid and nasty in the summer. There's no infrastructure there. There's not a lot of cities or support or social organizational structures, and yet people went there. There was oil in the ground, but it was locked up in these shale formations. It wasn't as easy to get to as what we have in the Gulf of Mexico, or oil reserves that we have in, you know, Louisiana, Texas, Oklahoma. So it was really pushing it to the limit. It was one of the harder places in the continental United States, if not the hardest to go to. And yet people not only went there, people explored for oil, people developed techniques to get it out of the ground, and they did it when oil was selling for an average price of around $25 a barrel. And it wasn't a flash in the pan. They just didn't try and do that for a year or two. They've been at it for 14, 15, I don't know, maybe 20 years. So that's where I take things to the limits. And I say, if you can get oil out of North Dakota, then it's a whole lot easier to get in a lot of other places, and you're going to get it out of those places for less than $25 a barrel. But even more important than all that, here's the main takeaway that I want you to get from this podcast episode today. And that's the consequences of imbalance. You see, over the last 5 to 6 months or so, we've seen oil plummet, in some cases over 45%. Now, that wasn't because the cost of producing or pumping or marketing oil got cheaper. It had nothing to do with the cost of oil at all. It was the imbalance between supply and demand. And that's important for you to understand. For example, if you have your own small business, the prices you charge don't necessarily have anything to do with your cost. You can produce something for a nickel, and maybe you can sell it for $10,000. The cost of production is only one element used to construct the price that the consumer is willing to pay. If you're in a position where you own your own business, or where you can set prices for products you sell, don't limit yourself by cost factors. Look beyond that. Determine ways where you can add value, or where you can find clients and markets where they're willing to pay substantially more than what it costs you to produce. You see, even with a commodity like oil that's extremely fungible, the market price is not so much determined on what it costs to pull it, mine it out of the ground. The price is determined by what consumers are willing to pay for it. And if there's an imbalance between supply and demand, that price will vary dramatically. So think about that as it relates to your own life. If a fungible commodity like oil can fluctuate so drastically in price, how much more so can a product that you create and that you add value to, whether it's a product or a service? Try and make it the best as you can. distinguish it and differentiate it from all your competitors, and then market and communicate that value to people so they're willing to pay more for it. The other way I think you can apply the consequences of imbalance in your life is not in economic terms, but think in terms of your health or your interpersonal relationships or your stress level. Whenever those things are balanced, then you feel good, you feel productive, you feel loved, you can function. But if those things get slightly out of balance, if they become imbalanced, think about how much your productivity goes down, how miserable you feel, how emaciated you may become. Think of that in terms of your health. Your body temperature is pretty much a constant 98.6, but if you get a fever or something, and it goes up just a little bit to 100, 102, 100, 304, that really isn't that much of an extreme from a temperature standpoint, but it wreaks havoc on your body and on your health. The same way would be with hypothermia. If the core temperature of your body gets much below that 98.6 and your body goes out of balance, well, then it becomes a life or death situation. So try and live your life in balance and in harmony. And when you're looking for investment opportunities, watch in the marketplace for anomalies. Watch for those imbalances or those areas that are niches or edges, or what we call in economics, the margins. That's where profit can be made. Right now in these markets, we're experiencing a huge imbalance. In the energy markets, it's not over yet. There are going to be a lot of opportunities to either make a lot of money or lose a lot of money. So stick with me over the next coming days and weeks, and we'll see how this whole thing plays out. As I mentioned on our next episode, I'll come back to you after the market close on Friday, tomorrow. We'll wrap up things for the week. We'll do a market review and analysis, and we'll try and determine whether we're headed for a Santa Claus rally or whether there's more volatility on the horizon. As always, if you have questions, comments, or you'd like to get me a message, you can do that through our website, which is wealthsteading.com. Until next time, this is John Pugliano wishing you the very best of returns.